Okay, so tonight in the Senior Fellowship, we're going to tackle some of the areas that I suggested to look over or to learn if you didn't, have any resources for Shavuot, with some questions that we discussed last week, and now we can sort of like discuss them and analyze them. So last week, we dealt with this, we did the second chapter of Megillat Rut, where the scene, I'll just share a screen for a moment. That the Naomi comes back with her daughter-in-law Ruth, and she had, Naomi had lost her husband Elimelech in Moab, her two sons Mahlon and Chilion, and obviously they don't have a lot of money because they're not working outside the home, and there's nobody to support them. But it's interesting that it's Ruth that brings up, says, I would like to go to the fields and glean among the ears of grain behind someone who may show me kindness. Which then Ruth, then Naomi says, yes, daughter, go. And then off she went. She went to the into a field and behind the reapers. And as luck would have it, it was a piece of land belonging to Boaz, who was of Elimelech's family. So the question I asked you guys last week is, why was Naomi passive in dealing with her food insecurity? And conversely, why was Ruth active and diligent in her food gathering? So I guess that's the first question. How, if you didn't think about it before, what do you guys say now? Any thoughts? I'll give you guys a little bit of a hint. In other words, in general, when people confronted with a challenge or a, a bad situation, there are different responses. So, how would you explain that? I don't want to give too much away, but from a different response to challenge, life challenges, which all of us will face, there are different possible responses. What response was, and how do you explain Naomi's passive response? How do you explain Ruth's active response? And then we can apply it to our given situation of right now. Any ideas?
I don't want to say Ruth would be like the toilet paper hoarders, but she got a little nervous, perhaps, and was like, I need to go out there and be proactive and make sure things are taken care of.
Right. In other words, basically, when people suffer tragedy or it's a bad time, like right now, not only do we have COVID, we have violence. I was shared a video. Somebody drove this morning down Fifth Avenue, and every single shop is boarded up. Some are boarded up because their windows were smashed and all their stuff was taken. Some of them were boarded up in advance so they didn't lose everything. But it was a disaster.
That video is horrifying.
Right. So it's like it's shocking. I've walked those streets, those same blocks, hundreds of times. And those are the preeminent stores that give, makes New York City a fashion, capital of the world, or one of the capitals of the world. And all the stuff was basically stolen. I don't think anybody disputes that George Floyd's murder was a tragedy, but that does not in any way, shape, or form give you a right to loot and pillage to make a case. That seems not right. And not only that, people who are trying to, whose stores have been closed because it's not allowed to be open for the last 2 months, now just suffer an additional setback. You're causing more people to suffer, whatever. So right now in a bad situation. So basically, people respond to bad situations in three ways: fight, flight, or freezing. The fight is Ruth's approach. Okay, I don't have a husband. my mother-in-law has no husband. We don't obviously have any clear source of income. Obviously, the cupboard's going to be bare pretty darn soon. And instead of waiting for somebody to knock on the door and hand us, you know, boxes of food, I need to get out there and hustle. That's the fight response, okay? And her approach is that she already apparently knew that, interesting, she already knew that there was a custom in the Jewish community, not custom, but law, that all poor are allowed to go into the fields during harvest time and literally stand behind the reapers and gather all the fallen sheaves of wheat or barley. Sweet. That's the fight response. Then there's the freeze response, which is basically the situation is so overwhelming, you fall into a state of paralysis. You don't do anything. Then, of course, there's the flight response, which is, you know, run away from the situation. Naomi's not running away from the situation. Basically, she seems to be a little frozen. So now, again, nobody's blaming that because it's not so simple how to deal with difficulties and setbacks, which everybody's going to face in their life. Your goal is to try to, if you are frozen, try to, with the help of others maybe, to get into a more active fight response. In other words, I know this is a bad situation. These are the cards I'm dealing with. What can I think of? What are my options here? What can I do? So, in a certain sense, Ruth is taking a much more active, proactive response there. I just love this example. So we've been pretty careful about, we have not gone to, my wife and I and our family, we've not gone to a store since the middle of, since it started in mid-March. Right now we're up to, June 3rd. How do we work? So my wife found one, there was a vegetable and fruit a purveyor whose business was serving restaurants in Long Island, who quickly pivoted because, you know, the restaurants were closed, and they're still closed, except for some for takeout, whatever. So basically, if that person would have frozen, he and all of his workers would have basically gone out of business and would have been destitute. He quickly pivoted, and then says, instead of serving and delivering fruit and vegetables to restaurants, he, like, in a couple of days, changed his website for residential and worked out a whole system of delivery of so he can maintain his business and hustle. So that's a beautiful example of, you know, if he didn't do anything, he would have been out of business and all of his workers would have been destitute. But he was able to have the energy, the emotional bandwidth, if you will, to think, you know, to pivot, see an opportunity, and then get out there and make it successful. So it's just, and market it rather rapidly. So that's a great example. Any questions, comments?
Just, you know, under that theme, I'm sort of doing something similar. I'm putting together a legal product to help people defend themselves against the wave of eviction that are coming our way. So it sort of seems that that's like in a similar vein of what you're saying.
Yes. In other words, to deal with a bad situation, again, when there's rapid change, there's also opportunities. So, you know, if I would have told you 3 months ago that Zoom, which we always used in, you know, senior fellowship, as a backup, you know what I mean? If those people couldn't make it, or people were out of town, I would put on the old Zoom, and we'd do Zoom, you know. Little we know that, you know, suddenly they would get like 200 million new, 250 million new subscribers, like in a month. So, and if you knew that information, you could have bought the stock and become quite wealthy. So, if you had that tip in advance. Anyways, let's go on to the next part. Anybody want to read? All right, Shannon, read out the next part of the episode. We'll just refresh everybody's recollection.
Presently, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem. He greeted the reapers, "The Lord be with you," and they responded, "The Lord bless you." Boaz said to the servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose girl is that?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is a Moabite girl who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." He said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers. She has been on her feet ever since she came this morning. She has rested but little in the hut." Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen to me, daughter. Don't go to glean in another field. Don't go elsewhere, but stay here close to my girls. Keep your eyes on the field they are reaping and follow them. I have ordered the men not to molest you, and when you are thirsty, go to the jars and drink some of the water that the men have drawn." She prostrated herself with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why are you so kind as to pull me out when I am a foreigner?" Boaz said in reply, "I have been told of all that you did for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, that you left your father and mother and the land of your birth and came to a people you had not known before. May the Lord reward your deeds. You have a full recompense from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wing you have sought refuge." He answered, "You are most kind, my Lord, to comfort me and to speak gently to your maidservant, but I am not so much as one of your maidservants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here and partake of the meal and dip your morsel in the vinegar." So she sat down beside the reapers. He handed her roasted grain, and she ate her fill and had some left over. When she got up again to glean, Boaz gave orders to his workers, "You are not only to let her glean among the sheaves without interference, but you must also pull some stalks out of the heap and leave them for her to glean and not scold her." He gleaned in the field until evening. Then she took out what she had gleaned. It was about an ephah of barley, and carried it back with her to the tent. When her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and when she also took out and gave her what she had left over after eating her fill, her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be he who took such generous notice of you." So she told her mother, whom she had worked with, saying, "The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord who has not failed in his kindness to the living or to the dead." "Poor," Naomi explained to her daughter-in-law, "the man is related to us. He is one of our redeeming kinsmen." Ruth the Moabite said, "He even told me, stay close by my workers until all my harvest is finished." And Naomi answered her daughter-in-law Ruth, "It is best, daughter, that you go out with his girls and not be annoyed in some other field." So she stayed close to the maidservants of Boaz and gleaned until the barley harvest and the wheat harvest were finished. Then she stayed at home with her mother-in-law.
Okay. So this is the second chapter. That's the end of the second chapter, Act 2, if you will, of the story of Ruth. So, I asked you guys a question. How do you reconcile Ruth's active nature with humility and self-deprecation? In other words, when Boaz was being nice to her, what did she do? Well, Boaz says, "Don't go anywhere else. And, you know, don't worry. You could have the water to stay close to the other girls." You know, he was treat him so warmly. That's on one. So what was her response to that?
"How are you being so nice to me?"
Right, but she prostrated herself to the ground. No, she bowed down. That's an act. That's an rather extreme act of subservience. Or, you know what I'm saying? What's going on here?
Because she goes on to say that she's not one of his servants.
Right. She says, you are most kind, my Lord, to comfort me and to bring gently to your maidservant, though I'm not so much as one of the words. I'm not on the same level. Now, why is that? She's a convert. She's a Jew. Why is she putting herself down like that?
She kind of feels like she hasn't earned it yet.
Okay. You know, you just, that, in other words,
like she feels less than, you know what I mean?
That's interesting. In other words, you're just saying that since she's from a foreign country. Now, by the way, do you know how long it is, as the crow flies? Thank you. Appreciate that. From Bethlehem to Moab, it's maybe like 40 miles. Now, again, people didn't travel great distances, you know what I mean? That, but it was essentially, because you got to, you know, if Beit Lechem is here, let's see if I can get a little, let's see if I can get a, one second. I just wanted to show you, let me just get that for a moment here. Okay, here's Beit Lechem, right? I'm just going to shrink this out. Okay. So straight east is the Dead Sea, right? Madaba, that's basically, this is basically Moab. It's like straight across. So how many miles is that? This is 5 miles. Let's see. Let's give it roughly 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. Okay, 30 miles, as the crow flies. I mean, it's not, you know what I mean? That's Moab. It's not, now it's not that far away geographically, but culturally it was a different you know, Moab. They were a Moabite nation. They were a different people. Okay.
What's the Church of Nativity?
That's the Church of Nativity. That's where Jesus was allegedly born, in the manger. No, I'm sorry. That's where they slept in the barn on the way. I don't remember. You look it up.
That's where the three wise men.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, a little weak on my Christian history today. I got to brush up. I wasn't prepared for that question there, Adrian. Far enough to be able to be prepared to talk about Megillas Rus. All right. So let's. So what's going on here? How do you explain her? Scott said that, well, she didn't feel comfortable. She's a new person. She's from a different culture. She feels inadequate, and also that, right? That's your basic theory.
Yeah, like she's a foreigner. She's not one of them. She's new.
And she's poor.
And she's poor. Yeah.
Right. No, she's not coming in there as like the queen of Moab. She's coming there as, I'm a poor person, and I'm starting off on the lowest rung on the social economic ladder here. So that's one angle. But I think there's another theory. What do you guys say? There's another possibility. Connecting it to the other possibility. All right, I got something on the chat here. Okay. So what do you guys say?
Knowing where the story ends up with her and Boaz, is she potentially being coy in 30?
Ooh. But she doesn't know, but hold on. She doesn't know that she's a relative. It's only at the end of the story that she finds out that they're related. Now, and not only that, how old? I think I mentioned this in some class back maybe last year we did. Does anybody know, according to the Midrash, the Miguel doesn't tell us, how old, well, first of all, how old would you say that Ruth is? Give me an age. What's your feeling about that?
19.
No, well, she was married. I mean,
she
was married for some time, and then he died, so I don't know.
Okay, 25?
Okay, 20.
Probably the equivalent of being, like, middle-aged at that time.
I'm going to put her in the 25 to 30 zone. And how old is Boaz according to the Midrash? You know how old Boaz is according to the Midrash? Anybody? Just take a guess.
Probably so old. Gosh, why are they so old and the women so young? I don't know. Old, very old.
Yeah, 91.
See? Oh, right. Gross.
Right, exactly. In fact, he tells her, you know, you should be going with a younger man. That's in the next chapter. Okay, but the idea is to establish, what you guys tell me. I didn't post the third chapter. Why is Ruth interested in being married to Boaz? What's part of the idea? Do you remember this? The idea was that the next thing is about the redemption of the, or like this, there's the phenomenon of the redeemer of the field. Are you guys familiar with it? Did I mention it last week? Did anybody remember? Yeah. About, okay, so basically, just for those who don't remember or recall, is like this. Is that there are a number of, in the system of mitzvot, there's a number of safety nets to help the poor people out. Of course, there's tzedakah. Highest level of tzedakah is giving a loan or giving a job. But one way, one safety net is that if you're so poor, you feel you have to sell a part or all your ancestral land. So if you sell your ancestral land, that triggers responsibility for the Goel, the Redeemer, i.e. a relative, to buy the land back from the other guy. Or conversely, you sell to him and he gives it you back. In this way, you get land and cash. Okay, it's a method of helping out the poor. So what Naomi suggested to be done is to that Boaz, who's clearly a wealthy guy, purchase the land, and in addition to the purchase of the land, also get married to Ruth. For what reason? To reestablish the name of her husband, her dead husband, I think Chilion. So therefore, they'll have a child. It'll be associated with her husband. So her husband's memory will not vanish from the land. So she agreed to do that. So one of my Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Chay, pointed out that one of the greatnesses of Ruth was that she essentially gave up her romantic life for this virtuous act. You know, going back to what Daphne mentioned of the ick factor, obviously they had a child, so it was, you know, maybe it was technically possible, but clearly the age gap is not good. I'll leave it like that, right? I got the big laugh from Casey. Okay? So
I mean, it's out of my, like, dating app filters.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting dating 90-year-old men. Okay? No.
You gotta have that limit.
I mean,
the general rule is you should be flexible for 10 years above your age is the general working assumption. Okay.
Even 11 to 12.
Okay, fine, 11 to 12, fine.
Random question.
Go ahead, dear Suzanne.
Are there stories where the women are this much older?
Yeah, I wanted to ask that. Is there ever like a half your age plus 7 woman man midrashic relationship?
Where the woman is old and the man is young?
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, Sarah was 90 and Abram was 100, so they had a child called Yitzchak, but that was viewed as a miracle.
What about the situation that should have happened with Tamar? Not that it did happen, but should have happened. In theory, she would have been much older than who her husband should have been, right?
Correct. Right, in other words, why didn't she go ahead and marry Yehuda's third son, Shelah? She was supposed to be given his third son, Shelah. Then she would have been the older woman in that case. Well, she could have been the older one after, we don't know, Onan and Shelah. So she could have been older than the second one. I don't know. It's a good question. Nothing's coming to my mind, but that doesn't mean that there isn't such a combination. You know, in the world of Tanakh, and then, of course, in the world of Midrash, anything's possible. But, I was thinking another possibility here, that part of going back to Ruth's activist fight orientation, she understands that she's in a vulnerable situation. So she's a foreigner. She knows that people are xenophobic. Now, obviously, Boaz got the backstory that she's a great woman, but she didn't know that people know anything about her. She's this mystery woman. She clearly is sticking out like a sore thumb over there. So therefore, and she knows they're in a very desperate situation. So therefore, her strategy is to be what? You know, endearing as possible. Because she doesn't have a wealth of options. So she's being overly, maybe overly, what do you call it? I don't want to use the word sucking up, but, you know, she's being overly endearing because she's in a bad situation. She recognizes that her elderly mother-in-law can't take the wheel. It's all on her. So she's got to be, she's got to put the hustle. So part of the hustle, you got to be, you're in a bad situation. You got to be charming. I mean, that's, I think that's just a shot-oriented approach here. And, you know, she didn't reckon, you know, now, of course, everything seems to work out, which is going to get to our other question, which our other point, which was, let's read the Rob Boggs' fourth point. We could discuss this a little more, since you guys have familiarity with the Megillah now. Casey, read us out to the Rob Boggs' fourth point, which is an interesting issue in general. Go ahead.
Unmuted. The Rob Boggs' fourth benefit. This one?
Yeah.
The story informs us that one who brings themselves close to Hashem may he be exalted, will be successful in life. You see from the story how Hashem caused Ruth's success to the degree that she married one of the judges. The Rob Boggs accepts the Midrashic view that Boaz was the judge's son and merited that having her descendants become the eternal line of kingship in Israel. You see that King David emerged from her, who was given the eternal covenant that the kingship will never depart from his lineage.
There you go. So the Ralbag sees the four chapters of the Book of Ruth as a story of one phrase, Hashgacha, providence, divine providence. So, okay. So this gets to a very important, this is always a challenging question and applies many parts of in our own lives. What role did Ruth play in her success? And what role did Hashem play in her success? And what does that teach us in our own lives? So what do you guys say?
You mean you're talking about like ishtadlut, you put in the effort?
Exactly.
Sort of meet gone halfway?
Well, that's the question. I mean, is it, so you're already, okay. Yes, that issue, but are you saying it's exactly 50-50? Even Steven?
I don't know the percentages. I wish. It's probably a lot more effort on the human part. I don't know.
So, but let's start from the known, and then let's go to the unknown. What's the known? You have the story here by Ruth. What did she do? What was in her control? What was not in her control?
Well, she was probably married to the son of a very wealthy man. And then, she lost everything.
Yes.
And she has no one in the world but her mother-in-law, which is bizarre. This is the only story I know in all of canon of a nice mother-in-law. It really is. I mean, it's really bizarre. There's no evil stepmother here. It's just, it stands out by that alone. So,
okay,
you
good.
Talk about all you have in the world is your sad, bitter mother-in-law that's just heartbroken and destitute.
Yes.
And so she has nothing. She has so little, and it doesn't stop her from going out. And it's not that she was born into nothing or she came from this. She was probably used to living a certain lifestyle. I mean, they were wealthy. So it's just to have this sort of open attitude, not to be bitter like her mother-in-law openly says. I mean, that's an impossible attitude sometimes.
Well, so first of all, by the way, I just want to unpack that point there. I think that's as a life skill, that one point that you brought up, is when a person has a setback, it's very easy to fall into sort of a sense of depression, and when you get depressed, you feel. You look at the world outside of yourself in a very narrow manner, and you don't see nearly any opportunity. So the fact that Ruth was always able to be sort of centered and to be open to seeing opportunity, that she, in other words, she got. I mean, obviously, it's devastating to lose your husband, and then to. But she made a massive life decision to either convert to Judaism or go, you know, go to the Jewish people itself, literally move to Israel, which is a big deal, and with nothing, and then be open and looking for opportunity. You know what I'm saying? So that openness for opportunity is an amazing trait. And again, if she would have just been depressed, in other words, let's say her and her mother-in-law would be sitting on the couch there just having a pity party, just being sad, two sad women in the room. You know, it would have been a rather short Megillah. You know, nothing would have happened. So clearly, her taking the active role. Now, in the third chapter, in the third act, it's Naomi who makes the suggestion, why don't you go to the granary in the night? You know, you take a shower, you know, get all dolled up, etc., and go out there and meet Boaz in the night and basically communicate you and just tell him in an indirect way, you are the Redeemer, and intimate in that, then not only are you the Redeemer, you should also marry me as well, which is rather a forward thing to do. You know, remember, this is like, you know, it's like on the first date. So, and they do it in the middle of the night. That's what, that whole chapter three is an amazing tale. So she makes, no, it was Naomi who had the idea, but it was Ruth that pulled it off. And Boaz says, one second, there's, you know, there is an order here. I'm not the first guy. There was Ploni Almoni. Ploni Almoni says, I'm open to be a redeemer of the field. I'm not getting married to an additional wife over here. That's not going to be doing some good things for my Shalom Bias. I'm going to pass. And Boaz stepped up. Now, you know, we think, oh, wow, he's, you know, pretty, oh, it's awesome that he's going to have married to this young woman. Do 90-year-old men want to get married to a 28-year-old or 30-year-old woman?
Yes.
No. No. No.
They're tired.
No, you're done.
Depends how Hugh Hefnery they are.
Right. So clearly he's an active guy because he's running the field. He's seen, you know, in the story, he has sort of a vibe of a guy who's in his 50s. You know what I'm saying? He's managing a team. He's 60s. He's dealing with, in the fourth chapter, he deals with the leaders of the community. He's a community leader, calling people to talk about the situation, etc. He doesn't sound like 90. I don't know where the Ibn Ezra says 91 years old, but whatever. So even if let's say he's 60, that's still twice the age. That's, you know, still, you know, I don't know if that takes off all the ick factor, Casey, but, you know, I'll leave that for all you guys' imagination. But it's still, you know, that's, you know, at a certain point, you're done. Anyway, so clearly a bigger sacrifice on her part because she has options. In fact, he says, there's so many men here, you could get married to any of these people. Anyways, so that's a question. So she does a lot of stuff, but it is fortuitous that, number one, of all the fields in Beit Lechem that she walks into, number one, it's Boaz's. Number two, Boaz takes it, you know, finds out about what her deal is, you know, and then, of course, is very generous to her. And then Ruth has the plan. Then Ruth goes in the middle of the night to the granary and have that special conversation. And then, you know, everything worked out swimmingly, you know what I'm saying? So there seems to be a lot of drama and decisions that apparently God influenced people's, in other words, there's nothing miraculous here. So that's one aspect that, how does God's providence operate in a Megillas Esther / Megillat Ruth kind of way? There's no splitting of any Red Seas. There's no 10 plagues. It's just that there may be God's influence on people's decision making to facilitate making decisions. You know what I mean? It's a little more in a very subtle kind of way. Why does she choose that way? God influenced her in order to go to that field, make a right versus a left. We don't know. And Boaz shows up at that time. You know, all the things got orchestrated that people are having certain decisions. Like, I'm going to go over here. And then everything works together. So What is that? How would you best articulate the relationship between human initiative and providential help?
Well, there is something very liberating about losing everything in a way, as the way that Ruth did.
Okay.
Because at that point, there's nothing there, and if you have the grit and the openness, you can like sort of be a vessel, which I think is kind of why you read it on Shavuot, and why she's like the the quintessential convert, is because you can't like receive Torah unless when you're full of other things, you have to have a certain level of like not nothingness, but like
Humility on her part.
Yeah. So.
But you're actually making two points. You're saying first, one thing is that there is a power in the position of nothing to lose.
Right. There is this like.
People
talk about hitting rock bottom and all of that, and that's when they really find out like who they are and like the true grit and all of that good stuff. Like that's when, and I think we're reading it about Ruth and like she's doing all these things, but inside it must have been like very difficult for her, like her inner thoughts and like just waking up that day, going to the field, saying this is I'll starve.
Right. Right.
That's great. That's like a great effort.
So, but you're not answering the question, really. So, therefore, so you have the grit and the courageousness and the humility of Ruth on the other hand. And so how does, you could argue with a Ralbag, there's no evidence, the Torah doesn't say that God directed, who is always pointing that this is from Hashem? Who has a narrator in the story? Who's always saying this? Which character?
Who is the narrator?
Well, there's no narrator, but who in the story is always sort of identifying
Naomi.
Naomi. Just to give you guys to refresh your recollection. She's calling out the providential element here. She says over here, "Blessed be he of Lord who has not failed in his kindness to the living or to the dead." So who, by the way, for Naomi explained to Dara, this man related to us. He's one of our redeeming kinsmen. In other words, she's basically saying to Ruth, she's making the claim that this fortuitous act of grace and generosity from this guy is not a random activity, but rather it's from Hashem, or can be from Hashem. So she's positing that, and then the Ralbag says that really for her to go from being a Moabite convert to being the grandmother of King David is such an unlikely journey that to say that's just a series of fortuitous coincidences in a certain sense denies that there is providence at all. So essentially, how would you make a working definition here between the two components, between human effort and divine help? In other words, if she would have sat on her couch that day, would she end up being married to Boaz and being the great grandmother of King David?
No, she got up and made her own fate, or not her own fate, but she got up and put herself out there.
Right, she put herself out there. She created the opportunity where she could be. Just to borrow a word that Daphne said, that she could be the recipient. In other words, she create opportunities where the opportunities could occur. You know what I mean? In other words, this idea of hashgacha could be of divine providence is that, borrowing the phrase, the famous golfing phrase, the more I practice, the more lucky I get. But, which is that basically she creates situations where the hashgacha could operate within. You know what I'm saying? In other words, if God's not going to do an open miracle and just have Boaz knock on her door and says, I'm here with the food, and would you like to get married? Okay, so that's not going to happen. So she had to get out there and act in a very, you know, in a very thoughtful way, reacting to the situation, allow opportunity to happen. In other words, to quote the New York Lottery, you know, tagline, you need to be in it to win it. So if you want Hashgacha, you got to, in other words, if you want God's blessing, you got to be in there. You got to partner with Hashem. You got to be doing everything you can, and that includes working out a plan, trying to act strategically, davening for help that the plan has worked out, and you got to be in it. God's not going to, as Daphne used the term, if you don't do your hishtadlut, if you don't do your initiative, there's nothing that they can receive the blessing, if you will. You got to make yourself open to the blessing. The blessing's not going to be come a knocking on your door. That's not how God set up the world. So that's a very important life lesson. So we're all dealing with difficult times, some more, some less. So you're going to be confronted with three approaches: fight, flight, frozen. You want to be able to get to the fight perspective and navigate in a thoughtful way, and like Ruth did. And she's a fighter. Sometimes she is very passive and pleasant and charming. Sometimes she's aggressive. She went in that barn and started and she slept on the by his foot there. He wakes up in a fright, like, what's going on? And then she makes on demand makes her little plea there, and you know, that was a gutsy move there. You should check out chapter 3. Adrian, you want to say something?
Right, because I like this point of view, because I feel that when I've heard this before, it seems more like there's a magical sword in our life. You know, God, if he wants you to do something, he doesn't need you to do something. Well, I consider he wants you to do something so that then you'll appreciate the blessing, which might be true, but I like more like this common sense type of approach.
So let me share with you, in the Kabbalistic world, they hold like this. You should know the other position of divine providence. They hold the following principle. It's a principle called, the fancy academic term is called occasionalism. Essentially, it is that God, what you see, that the laws of nature, or nature in general, is really a human construct, which is basically an illusion, and God does all the individual activities. So therefore, God's going to do what he's going to do. You have to, your responsibility, you have to act as if your actions have a significance. And once you do that, then that's the price you have to pay. Your human initiative is the price for the reward of the blessing. That's a modern Kabbalistic approach. You know what I'm saying? There's no direct causal correlation between your initiative and the resultant blessing. I'm sharing you from the Rishonic or the Rambam perspective, is that God created the world with the laws of nature. You work within the laws of nature, but if you act with wisdom and with bitachon, acting in the best possible ethical way you can, an intelligent way, you can be a recipient for blessing. But your human initiative is a cause. It's not unrelated. So that's a very big debate. You will hear people like will say the phrase that it's all from Hashem. Now, they're only quoting half the phrase. The Talmud says, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is from heaven, chutz miyira shamayim, except from the fear of heaven, which, of course, is where there's human freedom. So Do you put human freedom in a more maximal way or a minimal way? So I'm arguing a more maximal approach. Okay, so there's a debate about that. You'll hear different people, and their approach comes across as a little bit fatalistic. You know what I'm saying? Like it had to happen. And I'm arguing it did not have to happen. In other words, if Ruth would have stayed, the question is like this: if Ruth would have stayed at home, would she end up being married to Boaz, and would there be King David coming from her? I would argue no. It's a product of her great initiative and her great wisdom and her great courage, and using Daphne's phrase, her great grit and humility. That made it happen. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
She made herself open and a recipient for the blessing. Not that God just went, bing! And then she was blessed. All right.
Right. It's just that sort of attitude that everything is for the good. But, like, is it really? Like, is there not unnecessary suffering that you could have prevented?
Yes.
In fact, it's better.
Yes. Yes. If I act like an idiot, then and I get consequences, those are Hashem created the world where there are where there are natural consequences, where are painful. It's what they call the, you know, and what they call they have a, it's called a natural onesh. It's a natural punishment. I act like an idiot, you know, Hashem's not bailing me out from acting foolish. That in fact it is for the good. That's how I'm gonna learn. I have to that person means I have to learn through the life of hard knocks. But you want to avoid that. All right, let's pivot. All right, all right. Let's keep on going. I only have a little bit of time. All right, so we did. This is a famous Pirkei Avos. Which one do you want to take? Appoint yourself a teacher, a Seil Harav, buy yourself a friend, or judge every person in accordance with favor. Which one of those three do you want to tackle? We can only do one. You say you want to take the third one? Which one do you want to?
What about the first one? What is like make for yourself a get a rabbi like you're going rabbi shopping? That's always the strange one.
All right, so make for yourself. All right, so let's see if we can. All right, so let's take one and three. One and three. All right, so let's Jade, if you all right, Jade, can you read it? Hold on 1 second. Let me share. All right, so make for yourself a mentor. Can you read this one, the Rambam comments? This is one of many commentaries, but let's take this one for a moment. Dad, can you read it? Daphne?
I can read it.
All right, Adrian, go.
Sorry, I was on mute. Go ahead, Adrian.
No, go ahead.
He means to say, even if he is not fit to be your mentor, still place him upon you as a mentor so that you can give and take, discuss and argue with him. And as a result of this, study of wisdom will come to your hand. As the study of a man on his own is good, but his study from someone else will be better established in his hand, and it will be more clear. And even if he is like him in wisdom or below him, and so did they elucidate the explanation of his commandment.
Selecharav, the Rambam treats it as a chavrusa, as somebody. Even if, in other words, you have to view them as your mentor. But the question I obviously ask is, how does it help to imagine your study partner as your mentor if they are in fact not fit to be your mentor. Let's say that you have a chavrusa who is in fact, like this is a classic thing at 101 Learning Wednesday night. Sometimes you have a chavrusa who you're given a tutor who is, you know, has many years of Jewish education under the belt. But sometimes you have a person who's just like you at MJE, has the same level of Jewish education. What's the value of making them a mentor?
I think that, you know, sometimes we tend to think in absolutes. We tend to think that this person's brilliant or this person has nothing valuable to say. And if we act as though people were brilliant, you know, it's better to err in that side than to err in the other side and think this person has nothing interesting to say.
But what the Rambam learns this Mishnah as encouraging to do what? What is he saying that you got to do?
So you're talking about, sorry, I had to step away for a minute. But you're talking about make for yourself a mentor, that aspect?
Yes.
So the way I think about it is when I have debates with people around, I'm not going to get into the politics, but when I have debates with people around politics, that even if I know that we're not going to come to an agreement, and even if I think their ideas are incorrect,
okay,
as incorrect as they could possibly be, it still helps to refine my own ideas and my own, and gain nuance by having to debate with them.
Right? Why is it?
I can also change my mind, right? Sometimes they do bring up a good point, right? But usually, even if I'm right and they're wrong, it helps me have to become really articulate about what I mean.
Okay, so you're 100% correct. What emotion, what attitude within mankind is this supposed to address? Remember, Picabo is trying to address certain ethical, moral defects that all people share. What emotion or attitude or quality or virtue is this Aselach HaRav, accept upon for yourself a mentor, trying to combat?
Is it pride or vanity? Pride?
Well, what has to do with learning, though? It's focused on a little bit, you know, specifically in learning.
Thinking, kind of get, I think there's two aspects, complacency in your views, as well as kind of an egotism in your views of thinking you're always right, and not thinking that other perspectives matter. So there's the perspective aspect, but also just complacency.
100%. Exactly. The man, people tend to be presumptuous that they think that their thoughts on a particular topic are correct. Why? Because they thought it. Why are they right? Well, because I thought it. What other possibility is there? So by getting yourself, so therefore, by having a study partner and you put them up as a mentor, person you're going to take seriously, and listen to they could have, even if they have less wisdom, but the fact that they're going to challenge you to articulate your perspective, as Casey pointed out, in a clear and lucid way, that is helping us get over the disease of man, of arrogance, that since I thought it, it must be correct. Second error is that part of our presumptuousness also is that we tend to think that our first thought or theory on a matter is the matter. But in reality, things are far more complicated and are far more gray. And your first theory or perspective on a topic will oftentimes be improved by being forced to refine it, because, you know, we're not great chachamim that whatever we think about initially, that theory is in fact a theory. I mean, Thomas Edison has the most amount of patents of inventions in American history, but for example, by the light bulb, one of his famous inventions, he had to fail like 9,000 times. Okay? So he had possibilities about what would work, and he tried like 9,000 different possibilities for the light bulb, which is like hard to even imagine, but he was excellent at being open to recognize that he's wrong. So having yourself a mentor, even if a chavrusa, is so critical, the Talmud says this phrase, O chavrusa, O misusa. A chavrusa or death. Okay? Which means is that the chavrusa is a powerful engine for growth. And not to have that, even if you're a fantastic autodidact, you're great, you're very disciplined, you learn so well by yourself, you're going to give your theories a tremendous amount of weight and currency, which is not going to be justified if you have somebody who's equal, certainly who's better than equal, even somebody who's a drop less, because it's enough of a give and take that they'll bring the truth will come out. Now, the better person, Aselach HaRav, but the better, who is the best vehicle to deal with unclear assumptions? And there are three categories. There's your Rebbe, your Torah teacher, your Chavrusa, your student. Which one is going to be, what one is the most source of learning and clarification?
The student.
Yeah, why is that?
Because they're going to ask you questions all the time that will get you to, and they're going to bring in a perspective that you didn't have as you learn with them.
Yeah, since they don't have, since the student does not have, you know, the technical language or a set of assumptions, you're going to be forced to clarify things down to the various most foundational principles. So it's going to force you to be clear as possible. So that's the, that's what I always, you know, that's why I've been enjoying learning with everybody at MG for the last, coming up on 13 and a half years. So I found that day one, and I still found that to tonight. From then till tonight. It's been a gift that keep on giving. Okay, so we have another. I want to get one more. One more. We'll call it a night. Oh, this is good. This is something people get. Okay, Dad, you get another shot. Last paragraph. You get it. And judge every person as meritorious. Go ahead, take it away.
Okay, and judge every person as meritorious. The subject is when there is a person who you do not.
I guess it probably means do not know about him.
If he's righteous or if he's wicked, and you see him doing an act or saying something, and if you interpret it one way, it will be good, and if you interpret it another way, it will be bad. Take it, in this case, take it to the good and do not think bad about it. But if the man is known to be famously righteous and of good deeds, and an action of his is seen that all of its aspects indicate that it is a bad deed, and a person can only determine it to be, good with great stretching and a distant possibility, it is fit that you take it that it is good, since there is some aspect of a possibility that it is good, and it is not permissible for you to suspect him. And about this did they say, the body of anyone who suspects proper ones will be struck.
Okay.
And so too, when it is an evildoer and his deeds are famous, and afterwards we see him, if he does a deed, all of the indications which are that it is good, but there is an aspect of a distant possibility that it is bad, it is fit to guard oneself from him and not to believe that it is good, since there is a possibility for the bad. And about this it is stated, though he be fair spoken, do not trust him, etc. But when he is not known and the deed is indeterminate towards one of the two extremes, according to the ways of piety, one must judge a person as meritorious, whichever extreme of the two extremes would be the case.
Okay.
Okay.
Let me explain this in simple thing. You got three people. You have the tzaddik, the righteous person, and you have the wicked person, and you have the unknown person. Okay. So a tzaddik, if you see a righteous person, a person who's well known of being a good person in every way, and you see they do something, and it would be a stretch to interpret it, you see them in the 7-Eleven taking the chocolate bar, putting it in their pocket, and walking out. So now it's a big stretch to view that just was not an activity of theft. What are you obligated to assume? If he's established as a great person, a righteous person.
That you misinterpreted it, that you have to judge him favorably.
Good. And let's say he's a wicked person. A known person is a wicked person. And you see he's done an unbelievably good act. But there's a stretch of possibility that can determine it that, you know, may not have been so good. What are you obligated to assume?
That it was good.
No, that it was bad.
Oh, if you see him do a good act?
If you see him do a good act, but there's still a possibility that it's a distant possibility that it was bad, it's fit to guard yourself from him and not to believe it's good. For there is a possibility for the bad. Let me make an extreme case. Let's say you see Hitler, doing kind things to a number of animals, feeding animals, or doing something generous being generous in some sort of way. As long as you, since you know he's a wicked person, you know that ultimately You have to assume that even though it seems there might be if there's a possibility, a distant possibility that really this is an evil activity, you have to assume that. What is the case of judge every person's meritorious when the person is not, does not have an identity? That person, now, it could be 50-50. So what are you obligated to do?
Judge favorably.
Now the question...
On the side of that is good.
Which, of course, the obvious question is, why should you do that? Why do you say 50-50? Why, in other words, 50%, this will, you can interpret it as being positive, you can interpret it as negative. Why are you obligated to go just say, I don't know?
Because if we did that as a society and as a culture, we wouldn't be in this situation to begin with. Because doing that prevents horrible tragedies from happening, prevents massive injustices from happening. Giving someone the benefit of the doubt is sounds simple, but it, when actually done, it could probably change the world.
Why is it so difficult to assume that the person did the right thing when it can be interpreted as also the wrong thing?
First of all, I think it depends on the society that we're speaking about. It depends on the values of the society. It depends where you find yourself in. I think the Rambam says that if you're in a wicked society, you should leave that society. But assuming that, it's a society based on, mostly Jewish values, like the United States, then I think there can be a presumption that people are generally, have good intentions. And they don't want to kill you, and they don't want to inflict suffering upon you just for their own existence. So, if operating under that assumption is positive, like you can assume that most people have good intentions. And if you just
but why?
Because of the Jewish values that have been inculcated.
No, but why is it saying that a person should don lekol kavod? You could 50% you can give a negative narrative, 50% you can give a positive narrative, you don't know the facts. Why are you obligated to assume you must say he did it for the right thing?
Because of the Judah first and valid, that's my opinion.
But is it related to the Jewish, I forget where it's from, but where it's better to let 10 guilty people go free than to imprison one innocent person? It's basically like that's what justice is. It's a foundation of Jewish.
Is that because you are trying to be? Is this an act of justice on your part? Remember, now I'll give you a little hint. Remember, Pirkei Avos is about self improvement of the person's quality. So I'll ask you, what midah, what personal character trait is this ethic trying to deal with?
Humility.
Why show how that? I don't. What does humility have to do with judging somebody favorably?
I'm just thinking of the letter the Rambam wrote to his son about if you see someone and they maybe they're poorer than you or they didn't have the benefit of an education, you have to really make an effort to judge them more favorably, to think like, okay, if he's poor, it means that he didn't have the opportunities I had. Or it's supposed to make you more humble and more grateful. And I think just act like a, behave better towards your fellow human beings.
True, but what is the? But we're not. We have to go a little deeper here. What is the default setting of people?
That they're good. They're made in the image of the man.
What is the default setting of what people feel about people?
Oh, they hate each other. Like, we're all suspicious and paranoid.
Right, there's a negative. Now, why?
Because of thousands of years of evolution and learned prejudices and biases, and then everyone's out to get us because they kind of were for a long time and they still are, and it's like a sort of survival mechanism.
But,
for Jews anyway, I don't know.
So the thing is like this, that it since we are, on one hand, man is a social animal, okay? And being that we are, by definition, competitive, our natural default setting is to look at all people in a default way as being what? As a competitor. So we will assume negatively. So to overcome that natural negative bias, if you don't know, you can interpret the information positively. You can interpret it negatively. The meta is, since we tend to see things in a jaundiced way, we have a, let's say, a confirmation bias of negativity. We have to overcome that by, if we're indeterminate, go positive. But if the guy's a Russia, if the guy's a wicked person, even if the guy is doing something that seems positive, you got to be suspicious because he already has a track record of what? Of negativity. You know, you see a gangster doing an act of charity, so you have to, oh, well, yeah, he's doing an act of charity, but it might be part of a cover-up or ways to get rid of ill-gotten gains. Conversely, you see a person who's a righteous person, even if it's a stretch, you see the guy pocket something, I guess you have to say, look, he probably has a good relationship with the owner who allows him to take things, free of charge. You have an obligation to make that assumption. But because the natural tendency that people is to go negative. Whenever I've dealt with people who are fighting, oftentimes they have this entire narrative in their head. And typically, it's negative. You know, and it's not founded. It's a projection. We tend to project negative things upon other people. So Don LeCav's Chuch is really telling you to overcome the natural disposition of negativity and offset that with positivity in the case where you do not know for sure, where it could be interpreted positive or negative.
Isn't arrogance really what's driving this? Because you said it's competition. And that's really like arrogance. You want to be at the top, but you don't.
Right, but I'm saying, but I'm being more specific. Yes, arrogance is the cause of that, but a feature of the arrogance is that I automatically dismiss others as being a competitor or negatively. I go negative toward other people naturally. I always assume that they're not going to do the right thing. And if you hear people talk about it, that's Lashon Hara. People go negative all the time. So if you don't know, if you can interpret the activity, do you do it for this reason or that reason, you have to go positive. If the person does not have an assumed identity, you know, as to use what you said, Adrian, he's a decent person. So a decent person, I got to assume is positive. I can't give in to my natural negative, cynical perspective because I know that's a confirmation, that's a bias that I have to deal with. Okay. There's much more here. This is just one angle on the Mishnah. But okay, guys. I think next week we're going to have a guest lecture. I just have to figure out who we're going to have. So
cool.
I'll keep you posted. I'm gonna turn off the video here.